Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Kamal Ahmed will be sharing a little bit of his disability journey. So, can you tell me a little bit about your accessibility journey and your diagnosis?
Sure, yeah. So, my journey started in, I think, grade 5-ish. My parents noticed that I was spacing out and I was not able to pay attention in class. And otherwise, I was a fairly, energetic kid. Maybe not so outgoing, like I didn't have too many friends, just enough to get by, I guess. And my parents noticed this and said, well, let's see, maybe this is something like ADD or some sort of invisible disability. Let's see. So, because they're both in the medical profession, they're both pharmaceutical background, and I'm very privileged that they took that time to, first it was just, doctors talking to them, doing a very basic verbal assessment, later on in, I think maybe almost grade 8 was, like, so that's about three or four years later, maybe grade 9, that I actually, got a psychological assessment done, and they said, yeah, you have really good skills in some areas, like math and stuff, but then in other areas, and it wasn't just academic, it was communication-based, a whole bunch of things, and that was what it was like. It was very strange at first. They never told me this is who you are. They just said, this is what the doctors are saying. I never felt like I was told to be lesser because of my diagnosis.
So
I never was told I should be ashamed or anything.
So do you think there are still any myths or stereotypes out there concerning neurodivergent types?
I think there's quite a lot. Off the top of my head, I think the first thing that comes to mind is, I think behaviorism is a big one. Like, we see kids who, or not even just kids, adults and kids who are maybe neurodivergent, and if we see them acting up, like they're yelling in a mall or something, we have to recognize that there's a reason why this is happening. Like, maybe there's a communication problem, like they're having difficulty explaining what they're trying to communicate to others, and that usually they aren't intending to act up, so to speak. Like, I think that societal norms say that certain things, like, yelling or throwing your fists, or even sometimes, you know, running into the street is very dangerous, but it's not that we shouldn't address that, but we need to help neurodivergent folks help themselves, so that way we can avoid them needing to get into situations where they need to, like, act up, so to speak.
So, your own...
That's, like, the biggest one that I can think of.
So, your own diagnosis, where has it led you, and how are you going to apply that to help others in your own profession, and just as you take steps forward personally?
Yeah, so, I mean, my diagnosis really, I guess, at first, yeah, it opened my eyes to what it means to be, like, it told me that I needed to start looking into what other people are doing, because I think that when you find like-minded folks who are going through the same things as you are, it's a lot easier to, you know, because you don't have to figure everything out for yourself. Oftentimes there's people who have solved the same exact problem. I have a bunch of neurodivergent folks who are autistic, who they have sensory disabilities, and literally they would say to me, you know, all I needed was somebody to tell me that I was wearing I should try changing the fabric of sweater that I'm wearing. Some days they just feel that certain fabrics don't work for them, and, you know, nobody really told them that, but when they started asking other people and they realized, oh yeah, we just change our sweater. If we're not, like, when we're shopping for clothes, we make sure here's a good one to buy that might not bother you. Things like that, talking to peers and just doing your own research. I think that's the biggest thing that I think really helps people in terms of when you get that diagnosis, just the closure that, you know, I guess it kind of answers some of the questions that you may realize, well, I'm different than other people. I wonder why, like, is it that I'm doing something wrong? And oftentimes it's not, it's just, you know, that's who you are. And, you know, there's things out there that can help you get through, like, problems that you're having. And in terms of what I'm trying to do to help other people is, I'm trying to, I guess, not only raise awareness of that, like, I speak very, very openly about that I have ADD. And, you know, I try to do a lot of things to change the world. Like, I'm working on some things for the deaf community, in terms of, like, I'm a software engineer, so I'm building some technology solutions for and with the deaf community. I can't say that I'm just doing it for them. And that the making sure to, just tell people that I can do those things, and that trying to show the world that you can do what you want to do, regardless of your disability, as long as you can control what your environment is. Because usually these neurodivergent disabilities are environment-based. So basically, like, yeah, your lifestyle or the way that you carry on is not, I guess, the best suited for people who are disabled often.
So, what would you like to add?
Recently, I ran in the last Canadian federal election, and I was the disability representative for my riding that I ran in, and I think that people really were surprised to find out that they had, that somebody who was neurodivergent would be would be able to run and would run and would progress the way that I did. I did very well in debates, and the people really felt that my story, that it resonated with people, that they felt that, wow, okay, so people who are disabled actually can do a lot of things. And although I didn't get elected, I've been working on other initiatives. I'm working on a disability justice training session. Building like kind of a disability justice training package for to combat ableism. And it's been really good. I'm the chair of the committee, and it's been one of the co-chairs, I should say. And it's been very, very good talking to disabled people and learning about how different types of disabilities affect them and how society talks about disability disproportionately from other types of discrimination or different isms, I guess we could say.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Landon McCauley will be telling us a little bit about High Fives. So, can you tell me a little bit about High Fives?
Yeah, so High Fives started in 2009 by a fellow named Roy Tuscany. Roy had sustained a spinal cord injury, and his community really rallied around him to help him through his recovery process. He had an amazing recovery and was able to walk away from his rehabilitation. Although he does have a little bit of a limp, he had a great recovery. He got a ton back. And so he started High Fives shortly after as a way to give back to, everyone who supported him. He would never be able to financially pay everyone back, but he figured he could help the next person going through a life-changing injury. So he started High Fives. That was in 2009. Fast forward 11 years, and, we've helped a lot of people. And, we provide sports camps and grants to people who have sustained life-changing injuries.
So how do you go about reaching out to the disability population to let them know that your work's available to them?
Sure, yeah. So we get on board with different events. There's a sit skiing event that another foundation is putting on that we're going to help out with. We help out, different events, and our, people who are interested in sit skiing and different sports will kind of find out through that. We've kind of got to the point where we're big enough now where, the hospitals know about us, the different rehabilitation centers know about us. So, kind of word of mouth, it travels pretty good.
So in your work, do you use any modified equipment or techniques?
All of our camps that we run, we have all kinds of different adaptive sports equipment, different surfboards that, can work for people with different levels of ability, mountain bikes, sit-down skis, lots of adaptive equipment for sure.
So for these athletes coming in for the camps, do you ever find there are any myths or misperceptions about what a person with a disability would be able to accomplish in terms of sport?
Absolutely. I have lots of phone calls with people who are like, I was a huge surfer and I'd love to surf again, but I've been told I'll never surf again. And there definitely is that misconception, and people think that they can't do a lot of things. But, fortunately, where we're at with technology and the people that are around High Fives, we can get almost anyone out, onto a bike or onto the ski hill or onto a wave. you know, the equipment's there, and we're able to get them out there.
So, in terms of the surfing, what are some of the most common adaptations?
The surfing, so there's kind of a couple different types of boards people use. Some people, like paras, who are able to paddle and have some core and upper body strength, often they'll use a wave ski. So it kind of looks like, if you imagine a kayak, where you cut the sides off. So it's like about the thickness of a surfboard, shape of a kayak, and then it's got a bit of like a butt print where you sit in, and then you use a kayak paddle and surf that way. And then for people who maybe don't have as much ability, they'll go on a bit of a longer surfboard with just something to hold their hips in place, and they're just lying on their stomach.
So in terms of the mountain biking, what are some of the adaptations there?
The mountain biking one is pretty cool technology. There's a couple companies making these really neat bikes, and the engineering is pretty unbelievable. You'd almost just have to look at them. There's companies that have put in 20 years of R&D and engineering to get these bikes to these points where, you know, high-level quadriplegics can get out on the trail, and then, you know, lower-level paraplegics can get out and, you know, ride jumps and steep trails and all that kind of stuff.
So, in your time with High Fives, is there any success story that stands out for you?
That's a tough one. There has been a ton. I'm just trying to, you know, on the spot, it's hard to think of just one. I think like every grand cycle we do, we have, you know, success stories that stick out. Like, there was a lady, who we were talking with who, her son was an active kid. He was going to engineering school, and he was out rock climbing and took a fall and got a brain injury. And so her whole life changed, like all of a sudden. You know, they're dealing with medical bills and, you know, traumatic brain injury. And we were able to call and help her out with a lot of her medical bills. Her son was a huge fisherman. We've since flown him. They were in the East. We've since flown him to California and brought him to a fly fishing camp. And that's just kind of one of the people that we were able to help. I think there's, you know, tons of those kind of stories every year. It's unfortunate these things happen. It's terrible, but you know they're gonna happen. So it's I'm glad that, you know, High Fives is here to help when it does happen, unfortunately.
So beyond the physical aspect of your work, do you find there are any mental health benefits for someone, for example, is using sport and the opportunities you create to keep active or to get back into an active lifestyle?
Yeah, absolutely. When I talk to people, I think our grants are very important, and it's, you know, it's great for someone to be able to get a piece of equipment or whatever they need. But the community, I think, is incredibly important. So we do sports camps, and we'll bring people out. And the community that is built within these camps, and, you know, with like-minded people who are all going through similar stuff, I think that's incredibly important. I think it's one of the most important things we do, actually.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure thing.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Blood donors are needed now as much as ever. If you would like to help meet the needs of patients across Canada, please consider booking an appointment by calling 1-800-DONATE, visiting blood.ca, or through the Give Blood app. The Windsor Blood Donor Center is located at 3909 Grand Maris Road East. Please note that extra safety precautions have been taken during this time, and only healthy individuals with a scheduled appointment will be allowed to donate blood.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex, For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Kamal Ahmed told us a little bit about his ADHD diagnosis. And Landon McGauley told us a little bit about high fives. In this segment of our show, Tim Fletcher will be telling us a little bit about his work with mental health and addictions. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with addictions and mental health?
Sure. I started 18 years ago working in a treatment center in Winnipeg, and it was, as far as I know, the only treatment center in that time that was really looking at addiction as a symptom of deeper issues. And so at that time, it was really kind of the idea of trauma wasn't around yet, but it was, okay, it could be mental health issues, could be abuse in childhood, and that was for parents who are addicts, and that was kind of the focus. About 5 years after I started there, Dr. Gabor Maté from Vancouver wrote the book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and really said that in his experience, everybody with addiction had childhood trauma. And so I'd already been kind of prepared to think that way. And so I just opened up this new way of looking at it with more definition. And part of what he also said is that childhood trauma doesn't just end in addiction, that many mental health disorders are really the brain's trying to cope with trauma. So it's not necessarily a true mental illness. It's a coping thing that has been kind of categorized. And then people in prison, people homeless, it's all coming out of childhood trauma stuff. People with eating disorders, cutting. And so all of those things made sense based on what I had experienced as a counselor working with addicts, is that 95% of them had mental health issues, depression, anxiety. Many had other problems like cutting, self-harm, been in prison, homelessness. And so beginning to understand the childhood trauma piece just really opened up a whole new way of looking at things that helped us begin to understand if we're really going to help people, we have to start going from thinking what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And once we begin to see what happened to them, then it's a trauma thing and it begins to make sense out of their life, and then we can help them.
So in that sense, I've always found when it comes to addictions, there's the question of consistency. They may say one thing in one moment and absolutely believe it, and their actions may tell a completely different story depending upon their level of sobriety at the time. Do you find that this ties into some of these mental health issues that you described?
Yeah, I think the big thing that for me comes out of understanding trauma is the working of the brain in the limbic systems and the cerebral cortex. And so complex trauma keeps a person in their limbic brain, which is all about survival. It's your emotion center, but it's also the child brain that thinks only in terms of short term, so instant gratification. It doesn't think in terms of long term consequences. And so it does stuff just because it's going to make them feel a little better right now. And so a lot of people come into recovery from addiction and they're still very much in their limbic brain. So they come into recovery because at that moment the guilt is so powerful, they want to recover. It's a feeling, it's a strong motivation, it's all in their limbic brain. But after a few months, when recovery gets to be hard work, maybe a bit boring, then their limbic brain is going, I'm not feeling like recovery now. So I actually feel like an escape from recovery, and it goes back to old behaviors. And so it's that limbic brain that is the problem, because it is driving the car, it is in control, but it's always thinking only in terms of short-term consequences, immediate gratification. And so a big part of mental health things is that they also play into the limbic brain. So depression, anxiety, that's all limbic brain stuff. And so it causes a person to go to a place of pain or fear, and they just want to escape. They just want out of it. And so the drug then is the solution. It'll take me out of this for a little while. So the path to healing trauma, the path to beginning to get consistent sobriety, is healing the limbic brain, retraining the limbic brain, getting the cortex to actually be the one in the driver's seat, and the limbic brain just reports to the cortex. It doesn't run the car.
So, just kind of wondering, you ever encountered the myth of using marijuana, for example, to deal with anxiety, which long-term can actually worsen the problem, if I'm not mistaken?
Exactly. And that's what the research is showing, is for a lot of people, their initial use of cannabis calms them down. It helps them be less stressed, less anxious, but over prolonged use, it actually makes anxiety worse. And it's basically the same, like people that drink initially just to unwind, to relax, but once they begin to depend on alcohol and become addicted to alcohol, then it actually increases their stress, increases their anxiety. So it eventually has the reverse effect. So that's very common.
So what advice would you give to someone who genuinely wants to get into recovery and has to go through this retraining to sort of stay on mission?
Yeah. I like the illustration of that they've test that was done research around riding a bike. And so most kids learn to ride a bike 4, 5, 6, and they practice. So riding a bike becomes a subconscious thing, and turn the handlebars right, you go right, turn left, you go left. And so the test was done, okay, let's take a bike and set it up so if you turn the handlebars to the right, you actually go to the left. And so they told people who had been riding bikes for 30, 40 years, this is what's going to happen. So in a millisecond, they got the concept. Okay, if I want to go left, I turn right. But what they found is it took 6 months to a year before that became part of their subconscious. And so the first thing I want people to understand when they're retraining their brain and their limbic system is this is not a quick fix. This is going to take a while. It's going to be somewhat messy, up and down, success-failure mix. So you have to be patient with yourself, and you have to be kind to yourself as you relearn. And then I would say thanks to COVID, we've been able to, we were kind of forced to put our programming online. And then what we found is the word got out, and so people all over the world were wanting to take our treatment program. And so that is now available, that people can, from the security of their own home, on their own time, take a program that's really going to help them begin to work on retraining their brain and healing their brain.
I'd thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
I'm grateful Tim took the time to be on the show. For when it comes to addiction, it's not just one disability. It's denial, it's the mental health impact of everyone around you, and you're not cured in a whirlwind, as some would choose to believe. But time and effort, you can be free. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal.
So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.